Day Drinkers. I'm your host, Derek Schulmer, and today we're going to do another cool special interview vignette, I guess you'd call it. We're going to be talking with whiskey master blender from Diageo. Keith Law started his career in 1979 in the Scotch whiskey industry. He's got a lot of great information about Scotch whiskeys, how to drink whiskeys, how to nose the whiskey to figure out, you know, what's a good whiskey, what's not a good whiskey. What's the deal with blends? Are they lower quality than a single malt? What's up with that? And a question I had, you know, if whiskey comes from bourbon barrels, how did they make whiskey in Scotland before they had bourbon? Also, keep an eye out for an upcoming Everyday Drinkers podcast with our guests. We're going to have Doug, we're going to have Kate, we're going to have some beer guys. We're going to do an Oktoberfest. We're really going to do it up. I don't know exactly what we'll have for beers yet, but it's on the plate. We're looking towards the future, the upcoming month. You know, Oktoberfest has started in Germany. It's time to start celebrating really phenomenal beers. So stay tuned for that episode. Until then, let's talk with Keith Law. So just give me who are you and what is your role and you know, a little background about yourself.
Okay, well, my name's Keith Law. I'm actually a part of the blending team for Diageo. I've worked for Diageo now for almost 2 weeks ago. I've been working for the business now for 30 years.
Wow.
I started working for the company in a grain distillery. That's where I basically cut my teeth with whiskey, working in the laboratory there, doing lots of quality control work, but a lot of it was based around nosing, not tasting of whiskey at that time, and nosing of new make spirit, which was made in the grain distillery. So over the years, in various roles, all within quality control and all of it involving nosing, and then latterly when we're working with matured spirit, tasting spirit, it's given me a lot of insight and knowledge towards attaining a role of a master blender, and so that's where I am now. So I've worked my way through, and it's given me lots of knowledge of maturation, distillation, fermentation. A lot of which goes towards helping understand flavour, which we can ultimately use and find in Scotch whiskies. So 30 years in the business, so I'm a bit...
Wow.
It's a long time being whiskey, but it's absolutely fantastic. I'm learning all the time, and you just keep learning because I've got so many great colleagues that work beside who are part of the blending team, lots and lots of knowledgeable people. It's basically, they're great to work beside. And so I'm always learning all the time. So it's somebody popped their head in the door, and I'm basically just popping them off. But no, it's a great environment to work in. We're always nosing and tasting whiskies now because we work with a lot of mature spirits, and it's just fascinating what you find. It's fascinating discussing the subject with my colleagues and exploring the tastes and odors and smells that you find in whiskey.
You still get that the fun factor and the newness and stuff, and you're still excited to go to work every day and do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting job. I mean, because it's also what invigorates your passion, because you see how people. I love working with whiskey. And I mean, it was really powerful for me. I've been working various things, and it was powerful because I started working in the business at the same time as my father. He didn't work beside. I worked in the distillery. He worked in a different role, but that was really powerful. So that set me off on the road. And now even you see new people coming in. I sound like really old, but there's younger people coming in. And I like to try and get some of the passion, because my dad was really passionate about his work. And okay, he was not working directly making the spirit, but he was like, was it basically looking after joiners and coppersmiths who were necessary for the distillery. But when we get young guys coming in now, we've got, you know, very bright people coming in, and I try to pass on a lot of the passion I've got for the subject. And there, and talking to people about whiskey, and hearing people talking out with them, my friends, colleagues, guys at my rugby club, things like that, people who love whiskey, and it's a subject that people can talk for hours on. So stop me if I start to ramble on, but I love talking whiskey, and it's been in my DNA, really. I've worked all my working life has been within Scotch whiskey, so therefore I'm proud to be still working in it, and proud to keep on the traditions of a lot of the brands, the great brands that we're actually working for.
Now, which brands do you get to basically work for on a day to day basis? Like, what is the brands that you kind of cover?
Yeah, I mean, well, of my time in the blending, I've actually worked on a number of brands, but my primary focus just now is working on Buchanan's, I'm focused on Buchanan's blends. But we can, other project work, we might help out or do work on other brands. But my primary focus just now is Buchanan's, and I'm getting really in depth in Buchanan's and understand the history, the flavors, etc. But I mean, I'm working on quite a few things.
So you have had a lot of, like, how many brands do you think you've ever had worked with? What, that many?
How long's a piece of string? I mean, that sounds like it's millions, but no, there's a lot of different brands. I mean, like, we've, within the portfolio within Diageo, I've worked on quite a few of the brands, great brands like Johnny Walker, J&B. They're not necessarily, some of them might not, well, yeah, some of the big ones, like especially Johnny Walker, J&B, and but currently just now focused on Buchanan's.
That's awesome. And so what really goes into distilling a blending and distilling of a Scotch whiskey, and what's really the difference between, like you had mentioned, the grain whiskeys and then there's the malt whiskeys? I know some of my listeners probably know what a Scotch is, and they know that Scotch is different than bourbon and different than Irish whiskey and Canadian whiskey, but what is the deal?
Yeah, it's I hope you're sitting comfortably. Well, no, it's not a lot. I'll keep it short. No, the grain whiskey. They are all whiskies. I mean, covered under what's called the Scotch Whiskey Act. I mean, grain whiskey. It's probably a slightly newer invention. If you go up, when I say newer invention, it was invented. The type of still which you use for making grain whiskey was invented in the 1800s, late 1800s. So it's newer. But grain whiskey is made from one of the main components of malt whiskey, which is malted barley. But what we can use for grain whiskey, we can also use cooked cereals. And just now at our distilleries, we're using cooked wheat. And what you do is, and then mix it. It's like you're making like a, it's like a rough beer that you make, and then you basically fermented with yeast. And then when it's distilled in a grain still, it's a continuous distillation. And it's basically, they can run all the time. So you pump in the fermented liquid, the fermented wash, as it's called, and you distill it off, the fraction. And the spirit comes off, it's quite a light sweet spirit, grain spirit, but it comes off at a slightly higher strength. Whereas for malt whiskey, that's what people tend to identify as Scotch whiskey, because it's the distilleries are normally a lot smaller, and the stills are beautiful copper vessels like swan necks, beautiful things to see, like the still house. It really looks really traditional, and it is really traditional process as well. But that's a batch process, and that basically distills the spirit in two batches from what's called a wash still and a spirit still, and it's 100% malted barley. The fermented liquid is made up from 100% of malted barley fermented with yeast, and then the alcohol produced is distilled off in a batch process in a malt still, and whereas in a grain still, it's a continuous process. Right. And what you do is, when you actually mature these in wood, American or European oak, and then these form either malt whiskies and grain whiskies, and these are integral parts of our blends. We need good grain whiskies, and we also need really good malt whiskies. And then when we actually sort of blend them together, you get different flavors from them because of the different spirit, but also from the wood, and that allows you to make your blends.
So with the wood, you said you used, like, what type of oak are you using to rest them?
We use, in our stocks, we tend to use the main flavoured woods, the main woods that we use American oak. We've got American oak casks from the bourbon industry. And we also have got a lot of European oak casks, which we use from the sherry industry. And so that's the main wood types that we use: American oak, American white oak, and European. It's sometimes classed as red oak, but we just call them American oak and European oak.
So this is a weird question, but I've always wondered, Scotch kind of came before like a bourbon, right?
Yeah.
So how did you deal with your casks before you, because you're using these casks that are American casks. What happened before there was like an America to get those casks from?
I know, we must have been struggling badly. What we did was, it's fascinating, because a lot of what's now adopted as Scotch whiskey, how we make it, as I say, it's covered under the Scotch Whiskey Act, a lot of it has been accepted and absorbed into this traditional way of making it. And I think, as you said rightly, the first guys, the pioneer distillers who learned the art of distilling from way back, like in like 1400s, 1400s was the first, 1494 was the first recorded what's a piece on, what's on. 494 was the first time it was actually noted down that Scots were making Aquavit. That was its first name, Aquavit, Water Life. And then, so they were distilling a rough spirit, which they'd use for medicines and things like that. But at the time, and later on, I'm not going to have a huge history lesson here, don't worry, but later on, what happened was the Scots, or the Scottish people, one of the main drinks that people used to drink, there's a lot of like ports and wines and things like that drunk in the late 17, 1800s, when these distillers were making their rough, probably quite rough liquids, like what's classed as whiskey now. And the vessel of choice would have been things like wooden barrels, which were used for transporting wines and cognacs or port and things like that. So they would just use these vessels. So they probably realized that, hold on a minute, this liquid, after storing in a wooden cask, is actually a lot better. So we started to use wooden vessels or wooden casks, at that time probably European oak casks, to mature the spirit. And then latterly, probably after the 1900s, when a lot more trading over with America, then we would start trading goods going across, and vice versa. We would start to take some probably very nice bourbons across, and then being Scottish, we don't waste anything. So we probably started to use the bourbon casks, and we realized the fantastic flavors that you get from American oak, the bourbon wood, well, bourbon itself, you know, like the really rich toffee sweetness.
Yeah.
So they've been adopted and adapted and inserted into this the way that we traditionally make Scotch whisky. So we use American oak casks because we know that they give certain flavours, which we now use in our blends, and also we use European oak, which we need for certain flavours to create our blends as well.
So there's almost like the symbiotic relationship. They make theirs, and you know, they're giving them away, and everybody's kind of swapping the materials to better their spirits, which is actually very cool. Because if you it's also hard to think back that, you know, in the 1400s, when they're making these Scotch, what we would earlier know as Scotch, it probably wasn't as delicious as what we're getting today. You know, everything was probably rougher.
I think in the early days, I'm saying 1484, I mean, it was actually a monk, a guy called Friar John. A man called Friar John Corr, it's a really historical document for the history of Scotch whisky. And whisky, Uscava, it was Latin, and that's where the whisky came from. It was initially called Aquavit, and it was historically so. But this liquid at that time, and probably before they realized or understood the effect of maturation, the liquid was probably pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd probably drunk reasonably neat, if not, unaged, as we know it now. So therefore, it was probably pretty fiery stuff. But I mean, it would be pretty wild. But the people were needing it, because at the time when distilling was in its early days, people were, they didn't want to waste anything, because they lived pretty hard life, like people who were like crofting or living in the Highlands. So they utilized everything they had. So therefore, they didn't want their grain to spoil, because they didn't have a way of drying the grain. So they would actually make a rough beer, they would then distill it to get the spirit, and they'd use it for medicine, keeping yourself warm, social. You know what I mean? It have a lot of uses. And then it's now that's where the embryonic stages of like the Scotch whisky industry probably came, it did come from. And then over time, things have been adopted and adapted and assimilated into what we class as the process for doing it. So it's got to be matured in oak and distilled in certain ways, etc. So it's so we've got certain rules. We've got these set of rules, the Scotch Whisky Act, with which we actually make our whiskies.
And one of those, if I recall, is that it has to be made in Scotland.
Oh yes,
one way to get your heritage right there.
Of course, I mean I know you could basically dismantle a distillery and take it nuts and bolts away to another country, but then you'd have to call it whiskey from that country. You couldn't call it Scotch, so that's why Scotch is what it is. And it's I'm looking out the window. The weather actually helps our maturation. It's today. It's very cold and wet. So Scotland's got a lot of things going for it for basically helping to make the Scotches.
Definitely. Now, I've read a little about this, and I kind of understand it, but I know certain people that are probably listening don't. What is the real difference between like a single malt versus a blended whiskey?
That's a good question. A single malt is actually the product from one single distillery. It's just so it'll be a malt whiskey from a distillery, say like, well, one of our, say like, say Cardhu or Dalwhinnie or any of our, that's a single malt. It's the product of one single distillery. A blend, on the other hand, will be a mixture of a number of different whiskies. There'll be grain whiskies and there'll be malt whiskies. So there could be a large number. I mean, I'm just 20, 30, 40 whiskies from 20 or 30 different distilleries. So that's a blend. It's a mixture of different whiskies, whereas a single malt is the product of only one distillery.
Now, what is the, so with the single malt, you're going to get what, like a single distinct flavor, where a blended whiskey, you have a little more control over what you want the end taste to be like?
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. A lot of the malt whiskies, I mean, it's people, I don't know if people are starting to drink whiskies. I mean, there's perception people might have about whiskies, but I mean, if you drink a blend, you're getting a balance of it. And sometimes you might find that there's some certain flavours you like within a blend which you'd like to explore more or you really like. I mean, personally, I like some whiskies which are like, there's some that are really fresh, apply green, not really particularly smoky. That's my preference. I like those styles. So therefore, what you might do is you drink some blends, you think, it's really nice, but I really like that certain flavour. And with a bit of experimentation and buying a couple of bottles, you can actually sometimes, or even doing a wee bit of research about the blend, you might find out what's the, some of the core malts. Then you might find, you say, oh, it's a certain malt, and then you actually buy a bottle of this malt and you think, ah, and it's, it might be, so the flavour of the malt might, it won't be, some malts are smoky, but personally I like the ones which are like fresh, green, apple. So there's certain malt whiskies which I like to buy and drink which have that, what's called the distillery character.
Right.
It's very fresh, light, green, and they're delicious, really nice. Whereas some people like, on conversely, they like the really powerful smoky guys. I mean, there's some real smoky, like the West Coast whiskies, like from Skye or from Islay. They're pretty.
Yeah.
I find them quite challenging, but I do like to drink them now and again. But they're not my dram of. I've got bottles of them in the house, but I wouldn't say they're the dram I drink all the time. I prefer to drink lighter green ones.
It doesn't necessarily have to be that you have a. One that you prefer over the other, might want to have a different, it depends on your mood.
It's true. I mean, like sometimes you want to just sit and relax and contemplate, so you might have a smokier one and you just sit there and just, it might last a while. I mean, you don't have to drink it, so you just sip it and just contemplate, or drink and or just sit and have a quiet moment to yourself. Or sometimes you're outside and it's quite nice to have a nice lighter green dram. So it's, yeah, there's like drinking occasions where you can have, sometimes different drams fit a different drinking occasion. And it's, so that's why in my cupboard I don't just have bottles and bottles of the same whiskey.
Right.
I've got lots and lots of whiskies, which sometimes I just like, oh, I quite fancy one of those, just something slightly different, and they can hit a moment.
When I talk with friends about, because I originally wasn't into whiskey for a while because I had some bad experiences as a kid where I might have drank too much of like Seagram 7 or something awful.
Yeah.
And then I just stayed away from it. Then maybe I'd say 6 months ago or less, we were doing one of these podcasts, and I had my buddies on, and we were exploring Scotch. I had some Dalmore and some, I can't remember. I had like five different brands,
yeah.
And I was like, wow, this stuff doesn't taste like I remember as a kid, you know, or
yeah.
You know, legal kid, but still younger. And it was, there was a smoky, there was more oak and different flavors. Were the one I remember was strong and like punch you right in the face. So.
Yeah.
I started asking around, and it was like, well, you know, people like, oh, the single malt. And then I got this impression that blended was less, like not, it was more lower class and used for cocktails, and single malts were upper class, and, you know, those were for the real hardcore drinkers. Is that not really, is that
no.
Perception wrong?
I think so. Johnny Walker would be spinning in his grave hearing you saying that, right? They are not, or some of the great blenders. Yeah, I mean, some of the blends, because we have the blends, like the say, Johnny Walker Black, I mean, it's 12-year-olds, and that's the youngest whiskey, and it's 12 years old, and I mean, the older whiskey. So therefore, it's a really rich, smoky, fantastic dram. So to say that a blend, okay, you can buy cheap blends. I mean, some shops do sell cheap blends, but there's, if you pick and choose, not pick and choose, but there is some fantastic blends about. I mean, like, and the 12-year-old Johnny Walker Black is a fantastic dram. So, therefore, to say that they're for mixing and for, they're not for really, yeah, they are. They're for really, a black label with water is a fantastic dram. It's smoky, it's rich, it's a great dram.
And so what brings on that smoke, like what's the property that gets that smokiness? Because I noticed that in a lot of the Scotch has like this, it's not like, not necessarily overpowered smoky, but you swirl it around a little bit with your hand, and you know, you just move your hand over the top, and then you take a sniff, and you get this, like, I don't know, it's like, it is, it's a smoke.
Yeah, there is. And some whiskies are really quite smoky, but some, and conversely again, are not smoky at all. It's to do with the way that they actually produce the raw materials for making the whisky. Some whiskies, particularly West Coast whiskies, like an Isla or Isla Skye, or maybe further north, some of them, they actually use peat for drying the malt. Because when we're making whisky, to make malt, you've actually taken barley, steeped it in water, and allowed it to grow under controlled conditions for 3 to 4 days. And then what you have to do is to stop the germination. So you have to dry it. And then historically, in the West Coast whiskies, they would have dried it with the fuel of choice, which would have been peat, which is like, you know, like just dug out the ground. It's like compressed basically grass and ferns and things. I mean, compressed for thousands of years. It's a really, really old, it's like old plants compressed, but they found that they can use that as a fuel. So these guys would have dried the malt, the green malt, as it was, because it was still growing, with over peat fires. And the peat, when you grow it, is very, very smoky, and it tends, this smokiness permeates through the malt, and we'd stick to the malt, basically, and flavour it. So when you actually distill the spirit that you make from this malt, that smokiness comes through. Therefore, some whiskies are smokier than others.
And that was, I'm guessing, originally it was done by just convention. It made sense. And then that nowadays we're looking at it going, well, how much smokiness do you want? You can kind of control it a little more.
You can, because there's some single malts are very, very smoky, like the West Coast ones are really quite powerful, but other whiskies that we know that there's no peatiness in them at all, because historically the malt was probably dried over wood fires or over coal or something, so therefore it would have been dried with no flavouring on it. But yeah, but some of the, but also which is quite interesting as well, I mean, some of the smoky peaty whiskies, you can actually taste it. They taste like, I don't know, like medicinal iodine. They've got a real maritime, got a real strong flavour,
right.
And some people love it. I mean, it's a lovely taste. It can be quite challenging to some people.
Yeah. Now, do you get any smokiness from can that come out in the blend as well? Can you keep some of that?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, when we're making up blends, we actually use small amounts normally of smokier whiskies just to give a smoky taste, because some people do like smoke. I mean, like, and a blend, it's nice to have a blend is actually allowing you to use component, some like a small amounts of different whiskies to form this blend, which is, it's just you find little bits of everything. You might find smokiness, you might find some sweetness of American oak, you might find the rich fruits of European oak. So that's what blends are all about. It's just transforming in these single whiskies, and when you put them together with some fantastic grain whiskies and fantastic malt whiskies, then you get something different, which is a blend, and you'll find little bits of everything in some of them. So you'll find smokiness and richness in American oak flavors, etc., etc.
So it's more like
an art. That's what blend's all about. Pardon?
It's more like an art form.
Yeah, I mean, it's, sometimes you're explaining what a blend is. It's when we've got an inventory of cask, we've got Diageo, we've got fantastic stocks of cask. We've got millions. I think in Alaska, it was 7 million casks we have. So it's almost like, it's like a palette of flavors you've got. So I mean, you can't all use all 7 million at once. But
you
when you're making a blend up, you get samples drawn from the stocks of the certain ages and the distilleries you're looking for. And you know, you've got a feeling for the wood and the flavors you're likely to get from these, and use it for screening them. And you can get some. It's fantastic, the flavors that you get from all these whiskies. But it's you just request little bits, and then you bring the blend. Use that to bring the blend together, and try to use that as different parcels of whiskey.
Now, when you're talking different distilleries, now when I'm just trying to piece together how this works. If you have a specific label, Johnny Walker, for instance, if they're doing a blend from, they're doing different distilleries, 30 plus distilleries or whatnot, is a distillery completely separate from a label itself? Like, does the label just do the blending and everything, or does a label also own all the distilleries?
Yeah, I mean, it'll come from our stocks. I mean, Yeah, oh, yeah. I think I get what you mean. Yeah, I mean, if you put a distillery name on, a brand name on, and then underneath in that blend, there will be lots of probably some quite famous single malts that we use, but we use them for blending as well. But also as well, there'll be certain. Sometimes there's certain malts which are attributed to that brand as well. So there'll be key malts. So you might have to have that. Not have to, but if you see it on the label, that whiskey will be in the dram, because you can't see it contains this and not put it in, because that's just not right. So no, you would, if you say this whiskey contains distillery, say Dalwhinnie whiskey, then Dalwhinnie will be in that whiskey in that blend. We've got to do that. We can't say it's in there, but I mean, if you see it on the label, it's on there. It will be in there.
So that you can have a label that actually has basically all the different labels can all share the same distilleries. Can that happen?
Yeah, but you could do that, but it's sort of, yeah, I mean, but what you would do is you different blends, but what you do is have different proportions and different recipes.
Right, right.
Because they have different flavor effects. I mean, because they might, you could try this at home, you could actually do your own blend, and is if you've got five bottles of quite distinct whiskies, and you could make a myriad of different flavors just mixing to different amounts.
Right.
And, two parts of that to one part of that, the next time you did one part of the first one and two parts of the second one, and you might get completely different flavors. So that's what, so you might have some of the same whiskies, but some of the same distilleries, but we've got huge stocks, and we've got a lot of, because we've got 27, it's coming out 28 malt distilleries. I better get that right. 27, yeah, those are the 28. So we've got 27 malt distilleries, plus we've got the stocks of other ones, plus our grain whiskey. So we've got lots and lots of whiskey.
So those distilleries would be sort of your own. Like, I'm just trying to compare it to, like, say that it was a tequila, where tequila might get their agave plants from 50 different farms that aren't really associated with the specific brand, and they're just buying them. Or in the case of wine, they might buy wine grapes from different farms and bring them in and blend them that way. Where I'm picturing the farms as the distilleries in this case. It's not like you go to a distillery and this is like the Dalmore distillery. It's a distillery that Dalmore might use.
Yeah, what happens is you have different classes of whiskies that you need to make blends. I mean, like, okay, you've got names, but you've also, these whiskies will be put different classifications depending on the flavors they give.
Right.
So yeah, so you've got, sometimes you've got a bit of a juggling act to do to make sure that you have the component whiskies to make the blends. And the whiskey distilleries, the whiskey companies as well, we actually trade with each other as well.
Oh, okay.
So we might not own some of the distilleries that are in there, and vice versa. Our competitors might have some of our whiskies in their blends. You know what I mean? So,
right.
But there's a wee bit of trade. There's not too much, but the trouble is we're all desperately trying to eke out our stocks, because whiskey is taking off big style. Uh-huh. And so I'm not saying we'd never hold whiskies back from everybody else, but we're currently trying to eke out our stocks to do as best as we can with them.
Right. So that kind of gives me gets me where I'm thinking. Like, I was just, as an outsider looking in, like, okay, we have all these different blends, and I understand all the recipes will be completely unique and dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's just where, because I read, this is a blend of 30 distilleries. I'm like, wow, 30 distilleries? Well, okay, this guy's got 30 and this guy's got 30. Are they same 30? Are they different? Do they have different numbers? So that kind of makes a little more sense. You're basically buying the stock, or you might own some, and then you're making whatever your secret, top secret recipe is out of all those to make it yours.
There will be, because like some whiskeys probably have more whiskeys than like 30, 40 whiskeys in them, but so it's 30 different types. But I'm not privy to that's getting towards really top secret information. That's the way it can go. Yeah, if it says 30, then there will be 30 different distilleries in it.
So what is this is a good question for those that are looking for affordable whiskeys. If I want to go out and buy a whiskey, but I don't want to break the bank, I know I can get whiskeys for like $300, no problem.
Yeah.
What is the average age of an affordable whiskey? Is it like a 5 to 10 year blend, or like what do you think would be a good economical style of whiskey?
A good economical style. That's like a Scotsman asked a question there. Economical. I don't know. It's up to personal taste. I mean, you can try, because it's. The age thing, I mean, like, some people might like younger whiskies, so they should try a younger blend, whereas some people might like a richer, older blend, so they could try it. But they're all in the price. Well, I know the price range is going to go massively,
right.
But like, aim for middle, sorry, not middle ground. I mean, go for some of the main names that you know. I mean, okay, I'm going to promote our ones and say Johnny Walker's, guys like that, and then try them, and then you can start to feel your way around the world of whiskey. Rather than just sort of saying I'm going to aim for a price and I'm going to aim for an age. I mean, I think it's a lot of experimentation and going to bars and just trying a different dram now and again and saying, well, yeah, I really like that one. And then you will find the styles and the tastes that you like. If you start at the really cheap ones, then you might have your Seagram, your experience that you had when you were younger, when you're thinking, well, that was a bit, it's just a bit, you know what I mean? It's not the blend that you'd be looking for. I mean, it might just be a wee bit rough for you. But, I mean, yeah, just experiment. It's also just experiment.
What is if you don't have any experience, what would be a good thing to experiment with? Like, where would you – because you don't want to start at the bottom, but you don't want to start way too high class because you're not going to appreciate what you're drinking. Like, what's a good starter whiskey or age or blend?
I don't know. I mean, just start with some blends. I mean, like, as I say, obviously, I'm going to be one for the Agile. Johnny Walker. I mean, Red Label. I mean, it's a great whiskey, and you could try Red Label, and it mixes well as well. I mean, Red Label is very good for mixing, so you could try it with mixers. Or if you don't, then you can say, well, you can actually then dial up to try, say, Black Label, because that's the next one in the portfolio. It's going to be a wee bit more expensive, but it's also older, therefore it'll be richer, and it's a really, really good balanced dram, won lots of awards, and a lot of people say it comes out as pretty high in its class. So therefore, I don't think you could go wrong in trying that one, but ultimately there's nothing to stop you trying other people's whiskies. I'm not going to put you off doing that, but I mean, it's good starting points, but then just experiment. Experiment. It's because that's what I'll do. I mean, I'll buy lots of different whiskeys and just see what they're like. And
yeah, I know a lot of people that are all about Johnny Walker, or it seems to be the name that when people think Scotch, it's like boom. You want this? You want to go Black Label? Because when I asked a few people at work, I get a couple people from England and stuff, and they're like, "Oh, Black Label." Mm-hmm. Like, well, what about Red? Like, Red's kind of good for mixing, but you know, they're at the point where they're like, you know, Red is. It's not what you want. You're going to want to go to black. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. As long as I just want to know, like, is this going to be, as a new drinker, you don't want to be in it for $100, but you'll feel a sensation of, I want to spend some quality amount of money to get a quality drink rather than spending cheap money and getting something just bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Black Label is like, it's like an aspirational brand because it's a well-known name, but ultimately, you're going to get a fantastic dram. When you drink a bottle of Time on Time, a bottle of Black Label, 12-year-old is a fantastic dram. So you can't really go wrong with that one. But as you say, I mean, it's aspirational. It delivers. It definitely delivers on flavor wise, and so it's a good dram to try.
Now that when you have a blend that's say 12 years old, does that mean that's the minimum or is that the maximum age in the blend, or are they all 12?
No, that's the youngest whiskey.
Youngest whiskey?
The youngest whiskey is 12 years old, and there could be a lot older whiskeys in there. There could be whiskeys 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. So that's the youngest whiskey is 12. So if you see, a Derek Shomer 8-year-old, the youngest whiskey in that is 8 years old.
Okay.
So that's the youngest whiskey. So there could be older whiskeys in there.
Is there any specific properties you're trying to achieve when you're doing some of these blends, like that you know people might enjoy, or are you just whatever you think is going to be fun?
Fun. Well, the thing is, the older the whiskey, you're talking more about wood flavors, because the older a whiskey, the longer it's in a cask, then it'll tend to take on a lot more wood flavors. So older whiskeys, like Deluxe's 12-year-olds, they tend to be richer. So that's like wood flavors. So the longer the spirit is in the cask, they tend to be richer, more complex whiskies. So that's why we were saying, referring to Johnny Walker Black again, if you get that, you're going to get a rich, complex blend and with smokiness in it as well. So that's what the age is all about. So therefore, if people have got a perception about, well, age, I mean, sometimes age can be a wee bit irrelevant. Some people are for age, but sometimes it's sometimes constraining, because you can actually get some very, very good young whiskies as well. But that's a whole different conversation. So the longer the whiskey is in the cask, it is richer, but sometimes, and this is the point as well, some whiskies can actually be too old.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they can. I mean, whiskies, as they get older, they're getting more and more flavors from the wood. And after a while, the original distiller was trying to create a what they call a distillery character. It might be a light green, fresh distillery character. But if that whiskey's in a cask for quite a long time, then after a while, the wood flavor will just completely overwhelm the distillery character. So, and it'll taste of American oak or European oak. People do like that, and the tastes are nice, but sometimes they can be just too woody. So therefore, the old whiskies, they're more expensive. That's because they're probably rarer, right. Because there's less of them. But sometimes they can be quite challenging as well. Some of the older whiskies, they can be quite woody, yeah, very rich.
I can see that.
Very rich.
Like with the wood characters in most spirits, I think it's very possible to go overboard where you're almost masking the what was once there, and it ruins what you're going for. Like you want to have everything. You don't want to just be one dominant flavor that doesn't let you search for the different subtle tastes. If it's just like, oh, this is oak, I picked it up right away, that's all I can really get, that's no fun.
Yeah, I think that's why we're talking about, we're going back to blends again. I mean, if you get a blend, you'll get a bit of everything in them. You will get some of the nice wood flavors, but they're not overpowering. They're in balance, they're in harmony with the rest of the whiskey. So you can get some nice European oak flavors, American oak flavors, some distillery character, let's say, like fresh fruit notes, and also some smokiness as well. So that's what blends are. It's like a harmonious blends. It's a harmony of those different things, and you're not having something which is completely overpowering the rest. You're actually finding, because sometimes you take a dram, you see, of the same dram, you see, well, that was quite smoky and sweet, and it's nice. But then the next time you do it, you say, oh, I'm really getting rich. You can really, sometimes, depending on, you can actually find something else out. So that's what I mean by they're a blend. It's a harmonious blend because it's not overpowered by anything.
Right.
So we're going back to the question about blends. That's what blend is like. It's just like a mix. It's a nice painting of using the flavors, you know what I mean?
Okay, so that leads into some tasting. So if I have a good blend, we could use Johnny Walker or any of your favorite blends. If you're going to sit down and you want to taste it, you want to appreciate it and try and pick out flavors and maybe write some tasting notes, because that's kind of what I do. I sit down and write tasting notes. Besides, you're going to have your color and your, how do you go about, like, is there anything you do to prepare yourself to do a good, you know, I want to sniff it, I want to do a tasting. Do you, any rituals you go through? Do you eat anything ahead of time? You know, is there, like, what is, how do you get ready to do the tasting?
How did you get ready? It's
maybe some stretches.
We do a lot of nosing in the spirit master room that we have here, and so when we try to standardize the strength when we actually dilute the whiskey slightly, because most bottled whiskies, well, cask strength whiskey definitely, that's about 60%, and that's a bit peppery and wild. But bottles of whiskey is probably around about 40%. But sometimes as well, that can be a little bit close. Some people like to drink whiskey at bottle strength of 40%. But when we're nosing and tasting as part of blending or even assessing whiskies, we tend to dilute them slightly with water. Okay. And we find that adding just a little bit of water, we take it to about 20, 22, 23%. When you dilute it with a small amount of water, and the glasses that we use are specific for doing the nosing and tasting, it's like a tulip-shaped glass, and we have like a little, it's like a watch glass, they call it, on the top. So when you add the whiskey, you add a wee bit of water, give it a mix, and we normally give it 5 or 10 minutes for the headspace, the flavors to build up in the headspace. And then we've normally got rows of these. It sounds a bit, it's not a chore at all when you've got about 30 or 40 whiskies to smell. We don't taste them all, so you just go along, and then that just, it standardizes the strength, and then when you're adding water, that allows things to be released. There's certain flavors can be revealed when you add a wee bit of water to it. So when I'm drinking personally, when I'm drinking a dram at home, I like to add a wee bit of water to it. But some people like to drink it straight or on the rocks or whatever it is. So, but when we are scientifically or assessing them, we dilute them, and then we then nose them and looking for certain recognizable odors which we know and are trained to detect.
So, okay, that's good to know, because I like to try and be as, like, I want to know, you know, when I'm reviewing something, I'd like to review it as you guys would appreciate it when you're going through the test. So if I added, now you were adding like a spring water or like a lukewarm?
Well, the tap water in Scotland is pretty good.
Okay.
So we just tend to use like a good tap water, or we've got like drinking machines and vending machines. So we just take the cold, nice cold water. It's not been stored at all. I mean, it's just quite fresh or freshly run water. Really good water at the tap or the faucet.
Okay.
Give it a good run, like nice fresh water, and it tends to be quite cold when it comes at the taps. And so we don't heat it or cool it. We just tend to use it straight at the tap. And or as I say, some people, if they want to, they can add a bit of ice, but we tend to just use ambient temperature, and it's and you can detect most of the things you're looking for when you're nosing the whiskey, and also as well, I mean, when you're tasting it, if you taste a whiskey as well, it's the warmth of your mouth which helps to reveal the flavours as well. So
right.
You might have a really cold sensation, or the whiskey might seem really thick or sweet or syrupy when you first taste it. Maybe normally bottle strength, but when it hits the warmth of your mouth, then you can taste things coming out, evaporate, and then you can taste different flavors.
And so, but what are you looking for? Like, what are some of these flavors that you want to see?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on the cask type. I mean, because if we've got a parcel of whiskies, a parcel of cask samples in for testing, if they've been stored in, say, European oak casks, and we would be looking for the flavors you get from European oak tends to be, like, we call it rich fruits. It's like Christmas cake, dried fruits, prunes, raisins, the right quite rich flavors, rich
right.
fruity dried fruits. So if we're nosing some whiskies, we'd be looking for those flavors, and vice versa, if it was cask, it was spirits from, say, American oak, we'd be looking for butterscotch, vanilla, toffee, bourbon notes,
right.
like sweet toffee, coconut, like notes. That's American oak, European oak. So then you might also look for things like distillery characters, and distillery character can be like smoky, because smoky is a distillery character, so you look for some of that.
Okay.
And also there's ones that my personal favorite, like fresh fruits, that's a distillery character again. So there's some like apples, like fresh apples, fresh pears, things like that, and that's a distillery character as well. So you can, and then in between that, like you've probably seen lots of these flavour wheels for Scotch whisky. There is just so many different, but that's people just trying to put a name onto things that they can smell and sometimes taste in the whiskies. And
right.
'Cause people might say they can smell banana, but it doesn't mean you see that there's the chemicals which give banana its flavour are in there. It's just something reminiscent of banana, you know what I mean? Or toffee, it's reminiscent of toffee.
Right, right.
So it's just trying to put words or describe what you can actually nose and taste in some whiskies.
Yeah, what I've done is typically if I sniff something in, I don't know, some fruit or something pops into my head, it must be there. Because why would my brain trigger that? You know, it's obviously not infused with a coconut, but
yeah,
if it comes out, it might happen to other people too.
There is, well, certainly one of them is the vanillin. I mean, vanilla. The vanillin is found in wood. American oaks high in vanillin, and so therefore the taste of like butterscotch or toffee, vanilla, or custard, the flavour is in there. So what makes them taste like that is actually vanillin, which is actually from the wood. But yeah, there's a lot of things are just reminiscent of. I mean, like the coconut flavor from American oak is a compound called known as lactones. So it's reminiscent of coconut. It's coconut-like. But as you say, the taste receptors and the triggers that you've got in your brain, it's actually firing them, and it's very like that.
Right.
Some of them might be almost identical, but some of them are just like that. So you think, oh, I can smell this or I can smell that. Because apples, the whiskies I like, I can smell like green apples, fresh apples, pears from them. Some people might not pick it up as well as how I pick it up, because I'm looking for that. But some people might find something else, because they might be more sensitive to, say, I don't know, peatiness or something else. So some people are stronger at picking up other things than other people, because you might be sitting with a dram with one of your friends and you might say, oh, I'm getting loads and loads of, let's say, coconut. And your friend might say, no, I'm getting real, like, it's sweet, but I'm not getting coconut. So you might be good at picking it up, but he's picking up something else, and you're talking about the same whiskey.
Right.
But sometimes you can both say, oh, yeah, I get that, because we do that when we're nosing and tasting across in the Spirit Master Room, you can actually, oh yeah, get that, get this.
So that's kind of neat, because I kind of find there's a lot of fun involved with, like when we do our specific podcast on Scotch or whatnot, to be able to sit down and go, I'm getting this. And, you know, somebody, it might not even be the same brands, but you could be like, hey, yeah, I'm kind of getting that out of this. Or like the smokiness, for instance, was a good one, where everybody's like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of getting a little bit. Some people get a lot, depending. So you can kind of get an idea of what some of the neat properties are.
Yeah, it's also worth time. It's worth taking time as well, because sometimes what you can do is you can actually, if you pick up a certain brand that you like to drink and you say, well, I'm getting this off it, like I say, you get peakiness of it. But what's also quite good to do is actually pick up that, like, you recognize that nose, that smell or taste, and also you can, it's like not physically, just like simply put it to one side. Also, like, okay, I can get that, but what else can I find?
Right.
You know what I mean? You can go past it as well, and that allows you to explore further into whiskies, and you can probably find other things in there as well.
Yeah, keep an open mind while you're drinking it.
Yeah, just say, well, just okay, I'm getting the smokiness, and but every time you drink it, say, I'm getting smoky, but just say, okay, what else is there apart from smoky?
Right, and I found if I drink it a couple times, and I kind of adapt and understand that flavor, that I can kind of get past it to move on to the next flavor, and it might take a couple sips or a couple scents to kind of get to that level, but you can get there. So you had mentioned the adding water, but when you're drinking, do you like at home, would you add water? Would you add ice? Do you drink it straight, or is it depend on your mood?
I tend to just drink my drams just with a wee bit of water. Sorry, a small bit of water. Yeah. Sometimes I say I'll have same again. It's basically if you pour a volume of whiskey, I'll pour in the same again of water. But that's the maximum I do. I don't drink my whiskeys too long or too dilute. I don't add ice. I don't faff about with ice, kind of like, well, where's the ice, and try to break it out. No, I just have it with a wee bit of water.
Now, do you know, you probably know a lot of different Scotch drinkers. Is there a universal technique? Like, do you know people who use ice? Some people use water, some people drink it straight, or is there a common or more average?
Well, my friends I go out with, like, if we go to our local bar, we tend to just, when we're drinking whiskies, we tend to just drink them some two guys drink it straight and two drink it with water. Sorry, three with water, one straight. So that tends to be the way that we drink it. And I think most whiskey drinkers tend to do it that way, but some people do, like my late father-in-law used to drink it. He would whiskey just with a lump of ice, one lump of ice.
Right.
Not too, I used to get roused about that. John Dodgers, one lump of ice. But some people have a bit of ceremony about it, but I just drink it quite straight, and well, quite not fancy. Just like a wee drop of water and no ice. Thanks very much.
Have you ever put it in the freezer?
I have tasted whiskey from the freezer. Yeah, there's they do Johnny Walker Gold Label. They do a frozen serve and that, and that's pretty amazing. It's like a drinking occasion. You've got to have that as part of a really good meal. It takes a bit of time to organise, but if you freeze it and put it into freeze it. And serve it. You've got to serve it with the dessert. So you've got to have certain desserts like chocolate, toffee desserts. And if you drink it as an accompaniment, it's pretty smart. It's pretty amazing. It complements each other really, really well.
So
it's very close, but I mean, it's very syrupy and sweet. But when you actually put it in your warm mouth, it opens up because it's in the warm mouth, and you get the whiskey flavor start to come out, and they mingle really well with if you've got a really like a rich, creamy dessert with it as well.
Awesome.
That's a good experiment. Try that.
I will definitely try that. Now, what about Scotch in a cocktail? Is there anybody who does that, or is it typically? You see a drink more straight, or can you foresee people enjoying it in a set of cocktails?
In cocktails, some people know I'm drinking with mixers. I mean, I drink some whiskies with mixers, but cocktails, there's not. I'm not part of the I'm a bit older than this. I'm not part of the cocktail drinking set, so I can't really say. But I know that but people do. I have seen, you see articles in the web, or you see articles in whiskey magazines and various things that people do make up special cocktails for whiskey. And I've tasted some of them, and some are fantastic. We've had bartenders. I've been at a course one time with some bartenders, and they were making up whiskey cocktails, and they were pretty amazing. But I think it has definitely got a niche in there, and it's if people like to drink whiskeys like that, then go for it.
Awesome. And what do you what's the oldest whiskey that you've had a chance to taste?
Well, the oldest ones I've I've been lucky enough to drink some Johnnie Walker Blue Label, and that's got some very old whiskies in it. I don't know what actual ages, but I just know that there are some very old whiskies in it. But the oldest whiskey I've actually tasted was a single malt. Was a 50 year old whiskey.
And do you consider that to be? I mean, was it really good, or was it just 50 years old? Like you were saying, where it doesn't necessarily get better.
It was. Some people would like it, but it was too woody for me. Yeah. It had been in the cask too long for me. It was very dark and taking a lot. It was a lot of wood extract in it. But I mean, it was, some people would absolutely adore it. It's a very rare whiskey. A 50-year-old whiskey is not a common thing that you pick up.
No.
It's very, very expensive. It was expensive. I think it was about £1,000 a bottle. This stuff. So it's, I'm not joking.
Is that the most expensive that you've seen?
No, I've seen some on auction sites which are mad prices, but there's some very expensive ones coming out. I know that there's a couple of new Johnny Walker, but so anyway, yeah, there's some expensive ones out there. But I mean, I don't go with price. I mean, that's way out of my price bracket. I mean, it's that I don't rub shoulders with the people who drink that stuff. So I'll just drink my drams. But God bless them for drinking them. But I mean, no, it's. It's people who really are at the top of their game who can afford that and get real luxurious, fantastic whiskies like that.
Now, can you suggest, just as a good final question, I'd like to be able to get those people who are interested in whiskies that haven't really experimented in a Scotch. Now, do you think that the best starter whiskey could be the Black Label from Johnnie Walker, or is there something else that you think, this would be good general overall blend for the new Scotch drinker?
I mean, you could try them, but I think that might be just a wee bit, it's a bit, it depends what people's expectations are, what they're looking for from the whiskey. I think you probably won't look for one which is just, some people, you might get someone starts drinking 12-year-old Johnnie Walker Black, and they might absolutely adore it. Right. That's their very first whiskey. But some people, vice versa, might find it's just a wee bit of complex and they don't know what's going on in there. So they might want to just start down with me, you've got like Red Label, and then they can try either mixing it, and then if you say, well, I like the whiskey flavours, then they can start to work up the whiskey ladder and start to explore it that way. And then if you get into 12-year-old Johnnie Walker Black, then you probably want to experimentation. You want to try then and say, well, what single malts, as you said at the start of the conversation, but what about 12-year-old single malts? Then people then might go down single malt route, and then their cupboards start to fill up with lots of different whiskies. So, but yeah, I mean, you can start with a good named blend. And then something which probably mixes well, because you want to get people to experiment and try and find out a way they want to drink the whiskies, either with water, with ice, or with a mixer. And I think if you try with Johnnie Walker Red, then that would be a really good starting point.
Awesome. All right. Well, hopefully our listeners will be able to go out. And I know that around here, we have Johnnie Walker Red in the small little nips, like the little 50 milliliter like demo size packages or whatever, so you can kind of, for maybe $3, $4, you can go and experiment cheaply before you kind of commit to the bigger.
Just do that. I mean, and then as you say, you've got that, just try different serves, try and practice, or try and do a bit of lab work, and then just understand a perfect serve for yourself in a way that you enjoy it. So you could try it just straight with ice, or try it with water and ice, or just with water, or as you say, with a mixer. I mean, just watch, some of the mixers might not go, but I mean, there's some of the mixers like ginger ale, things like that, go fantastically with whiskey. So to try some of them, lemonade, it's probably different in America than it is to here, but I mean, but yeah, just experiment and just see how they get on, and hopefully they enjoy it, and God bless them for it.
Excellent, Keith. I'm extremely excited to be able to get you here and kind of expand. We've done some bourbon whiskeys, I've done Canadian whiskeys, but we haven't had the reach into the view into Scotch, so it's extremely helpful.
My pleasure, Derek.
I will thank you guys for helping us out.